The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo, Chapter 2, page 9, The Three Steps of Nature. We recognize, then, in the past developments of yoga, a specializing and separative tendency which, like all things in nature, had its justifying and even imperative utility. And we seek a synthesis of the specialized aims and methods which have, in consequence, come into being. But in order that we may be wisely guided in our effort, we must know, first, the general principle and purpose underlying this separative impulse, and, next, the particular utilities upon which the method of each school of yoga is founded. For the general principle, we must interrogate the universal workings of nature herself, recognizing in her no merely specious and elusive activity of a distorting Maya, but the cosmic energy and working of God Himself in His universal being, formulating and inspired by a vast and infinite and yet a minutely selective wisdom. Prajna Prashrita Purani of the Upanishad. Wisdom that went forth from the eternal since the beginning. For the particular utilities, we must cast a penetrating eye on the different methods of yoga and distinguish among the mass of their details the governing idea, which they serve, and the radical force which gives birth and energy to their processes of effectuation. Afterwards, we may more easily find the one common principle and the one common power from which all derive their being and tendency, towards which all subconsciously move, and in which, therefore, it is possible for all consciously to unite. The progressive self-manifestation of nature in man, termed in modern language his evolution, must necessarily depend upon three successive elements. There is that which is already evolved. There is that which, still imperfect, still partly fluid, is persistently in the stage of conscious evolution. And there is that which is to be evolved, may perhaps be already displayed, if not constantly, then occasionally, or with some regularity of recurrence, in primary formations, or in others more developed, and it may well be, even in some, however rare, that are near to the highest possible realization of our present humanity. For the march of nature is not drilled to a regular and mechanical forward stepping. She reaches constantly beyond herself, even at the cost of subsequent deplorable retreats. She has rushes. She has splendid and mighty outbursts. She has immense realizations. She storms sometimes passionately forward, hoping to take the kingdom of heaven by violence. And these self-exceedings are the revelation of that in her which is most divine, or else most diabolical, but in either case the most puissant to bring her rapidly forward towards her goal. That which nature has evolved for us and has firmly founded is the bodily life. She has effected a certain combination and harmony of the two inferior but most fundamentally necessary elements of our action and progress upon earth. Matter, which, however the too ethereally spiritual may despise it, is our foundation and the first condition of all our energies and realizations, and the life energy which is our means of existence in a material body, and the basis there even of our mental and spiritual activities. She has successfully achieved a certain stability of her constant material movement, which is at once sufficiently steady and durable, and sufficiently pliable and mutable to provide a fit dwelling place and instrument for the progressively manifesting God in humanity. This is what is meant by the fable in the Aitareya Upanishad, which tells us that the gods rejected the animal forms successively offered to them by the Divine Self, and only when man was produced cried out, "This indeed is perfectly made," and consented to enter in. She has effected also a working compromise between the inertia of matter and the active life that lives in and feeds on it, by which not only is vital existence sustained, but the fullest developments of mentality are rendered possible. This equilibrium constitutes the basic status of nature in man and is termed in the language of yoga his gross body composed of the material or food sheath and the nervous system or vital vehicle. Anakosha, pranakosha. If then this inferior equilibrium is the basis and first means of the higher movements which the universal power contemplates, and if it constitutes the vehicle in which the divine here seeks to reveal itself, if the Indian saying is true that the body is the instrument provided for the fulfillment of the right law of our nature, then any final recoil from the physical life must be a turning away from the completeness of the divine wisdom and a renunciation of its aim in earthly manifestation. Such a refusal may be, owing to some secret law of their development, the right attitude for certain individuals, but never the aim intended for mankind. It can be, therefore, no integral yoga which ignores the body or makes its annulment or its rejection indispensable to a perfect spirituality. Rather, the perfecting of the body also should be the last triumph of the spirit, and to make the bodily life also divine must be God's final seal upon his work in the universe. The obstacle which the physical presents to the spiritual is no argument for the rejection of the physical. For in the unseen providence of things, our greatest difficulties are our best opportunities. A supreme difficulty is nature's indication to us of a supreme conquest to be won, and an ultimate problem to be solved. It is not a warning of an inextricable snare to be shunned, or of an enemy too strong for us from which we must flee. Equally, the vital and nervous energies in us are there for a great utility. They too demand the divine realization of their possibilities in our ultimate fulfillment. The great part assigned to this element in the universal scheme is powerfully emphasized by the Catholic wisdom of the Upanishads. As the spokes of a wheel in its nave, so in the life energy is all established. The triple knowledge and the sacrifice and the power of the strong and the purity of the wise. Under the control of the life energy is all this that is established in the triple heaven. Prajna Upanishad 2, 6 and 13. It is therefore no integral yoga that kills these vital energies, forces them into a nerveless quiescence, or roots them out as the source of noxious activities. Their purification, not their destruction, their transformation, control, and utilization is the aim in view with which they have been created and developed in us. If the bodily life is what nature has firmly evolved for us as her base, and first instrument, it is our mental life that she is evolving as her immediate next aim and superior instrument. This, in her ordinary exaltations, is the lofty, preoccupying thought in her. This, except in her periods of exhaustion and recoil into a reposeful and recuperating obscurity, is her constant pursuit wherever she can get free from the trammels of her first vital and physical realizations. For here in man we have a distinction which is of the utmost importance. He has in him not a single mentality, but a double and a triple, the mind material and nervous, the pure intellectual mind which liberates itself from the illusions of the body and the senses, and a divine mind above intellect, which in its turn liberates itself from the imperfect modes of the logically discriminative and imaginative reason. Mind in man is first enmeshed in the life of the body, where in the plant it is entirely involved and in animals always imprisoned. It accepts this life as not only the first, but the whole condition of its activities, and serves its needs as if they were the entire aim of existence. But the bodily life in man is a base, not the aim. His first condition and not his last determinant. In the just idea of the ancients, man is essentially the thinker, the manu, the mental being who leads the life in the body, not the animal who is led by them. Manomaya pranasariranita. Mundaka Upanishad 2:2-8. The true human existence, therefore, only begins when the intellectual mentality emerges out of the material and we begin more and more to live in the mind, independent of the nervous and physical obsession, and in the measure of that liberty are able to accept rightly and rightly to use the life of the body. For freedom, and not a skillful subjection, is the true means of mastery. A free, not a compulsory acceptance of the conditions, the enlarged and sublimated conditions of our physical being, is the high human ideal. But beyond this intellectual mentality is the divine. The mental life thus evolving in man is not, indeed, a common possession. In actual appearance, it would seem as if it were only developed to the fullest in individuals, and as if there were great numbers, and even the majority, in whom it is either a small and ill-organized part of their normal nature, or not evolved at all, or latent, and not easily made active. Certainly the mental life is not a finished evolution of nature. It is not yet firmly founded in the human animal. The sign is that the fine and full equilibrium of vitality and matter, the sane, robust, long-lived human body, is ordinarily found only in races or classes of men who reject the effort of thought, its disturbances, its tensions, or think only with the material mind. Civilized man has yet to establish an equilibrium between the fully active mind and the body. He does not normally possess it. Indeed, the increasing effort towards a more intense mental life seems to create, frequently, an increasing disequilibrium of the human elements, so that it is possible for eminent scientists to describe genius as a form of insanity, a result of degeneration, a pathological morbidity of nature. The phenomena which are used to justify this exaggeration, when not taken separately, but in connection with all other relevant data, point to a different truth. Genius is one attempt of the universal energy to so quicken and intensify our intellectual powers that they shall be prepared for those more puissant, direct, and rapid faculties which constitute the play of the supra-intellectual or divine mind. It is not, then, a freak, an inexplicable phenomenon, but a perfectly natural next step in the right line of her evolution. She has harmonized the bodily life with the material mind. She is harmonizing it with the play of the intellectual mentality. For that, although it tends to a depression of the full animal and vital vigor, need not produce active disturbances. And she is shooting yet beyond in the attempt to reach a still higher level. Nor are the disturbances created by her process as great as is often represented. Some of them are the crude beginnings of new manifestations. Others are an easily corrected movement of disintegration, often fruitful of fresh activities and always a small price to pay for the far-reaching results that she has in view. We may, perhaps, if we consider all the circumstances, come to this conclusion that mental life, far from being a recent appearance in man, is the swift repetition in him of a previous achievement, from which the energy in the race had undergone one of her deplorable recoils. The savage is perhaps not so much the first forefather of civilized man as the degenerate descendant of a previous civilization. For if the actuality of intellectual achievement is unevenly distributed, the capacity is spread everywhere. It has been seen that in individual cases, even the racial type considered by us the lowest, the Negro fresh from the perennial barbarism of Central Africa, is capable, without admixture of blood, without waiting for future generations, of the intellectual culture, if not yet of the intellectual accomplishments of the dominant European. Even in the mass, men seem to need, in favorable circumstances, only a few generations to cover ground that ought apparently to be measured in the terms of millenniums. Either, then, man, by his privilege as a mental being, is exempt from the full burden of the tardy laws of evolution, or else he already represents, and with helpful conditions and in the right stimulating atmosphere, can always display a high level of material capacity for the activities of the intellectual life. It is not mental incapacity, but the long rejection or seclusion from opportunity and withdrawal of the awakening impulse that creates the savage. Barbarism is an intermediate sleep, not an original darkness. Moreover, the whole trend of modern thought and modern endeavor reveals itself to the observant eye as a large conscious effort of nature and man to effect a general level of intellectual equipment, capacity, and farther possibility by universalizing the opportunities which modern civilization affords for the mental life. Even the preoccupation of the European intellect, the protagonist of this tendency, with material nature and the externalities of existence, is a necessary part of the effort. It seeks to prepare a sufficient basis in man's physical being and vital energies, and in his material environment, for his full mental possibilities. By the spread of education, by the advance of the backward races, by the elevation of depressed classes, by the multiplication of labor-saving appliances, by the movement towards ideal social and economic conditions, by the labor of science towards an improved health, longevity, and sound physique in civilized humanity, the sense and drift of this vast movement translates itself in easily intelligible signs. The right, or at least the ultimate means, may not always be employed, but their aim is the right preliminary aim, a sound individual and social body, and the satisfaction of the legitimate needs and demands of the material mind, sufficient ease, leisure, equal opportunity, so that the whole of mankind, and no longer only the favored race, class, or individual, may be free to develop the emotional and intellectual being to its full capacity. At present, the material and economic aim may predominate, but always behind their works or their weights in reserve, the higher and major impulse. And when the preliminary conditions are satisfied, when the great endeavor has found its base, what will be the nature of that farther possibility which the activities of the intellectual life must serve? If mind is indeed nature's highest term, then the entire development of the rational and imaginative intellect and the harmonious satisfaction of the emotions and sensibilities must be to themselves sufficient. But if, on the contrary, man is more than a reasoning and emotional animal, if beyond that which is being evolved, there is something that has to be evolved, then it may well be that the fullness of the mental life, the suppleness, flexibility, and wide capacity of the intellect, the ordered richness of emotion and sensibility, may be only a passage towards the development of a higher life, and of more powerful faculties which are yet to manifest and to take possession of the lower instrument, just as mind itself has so taken possession of the body, that the physical being no longer lives only for its own satisfaction, but provides the foundation and the materials for a superior activity. The assertion of a higher than the mental life is the whole foundation of Indian philosophy, and its acquisition and organization is the veritable object served by the methods of yoga. Mind is not the last term of evolution, not an ultimate aim, but, like body, an instrument. It is even so termed in the language of yoga, the inner instrument, antakarana. And Indian tradition asserts that this which is to be manifested is not a new term in human experience, but has been developed before and has even governed humanity in certain periods of its development. In any case, in order to be known, it must at one time have been partly developed. And if since then nature has sunk back from her achievement, the reason must always be found in some unrealized harmony, some insufficiency of the intellectual and material basis to which she has now returned, some over-specialization of the higher to the detriment of the lower existence. But what then constitutes this higher or highest existence to which our evolution is tending? In order to answer the question, we have to deal with a class of supreme experiences, a class of unusual conceptions which it is difficult to represent accurately in any other language than the ancient Sanskrit tongue, in which alone they have been to some extent systematized. The only approximate terms in the English language have other associations, and their use may lead to many and even serious inaccuracies. The terminology of yoga recognizes, besides the status of our physical and vital being, termed the gross body and doubly composed of the food sheath and the vital vehicle, besides the status of our mental being, termed the subtle body and singly composed of the mind sheath or mental vehicle, mana kosha, a third, supreme, and divine status of supramental being, termed the causal body, and composed of a fourth and a fifth vehicle, which are described as those of knowledge and bliss, vijnana kosha and ananda kosha. But this knowledge is not a systemized result of mental questionings and reasonings, not a temporary arrangement of conclusions and opinions in the terms of the highest probability, but rather a pure self-existent and self-luminous truth. And this bliss is not a supreme pleasure of the heart and sensations, with the experience of pain and sorrow as its background, but a delight, also self-existent and independent of objects and particular experiences, a self-delight, which is the very nature, the very stuff, as it were, of a transcendent and infinite existence. Do such psychological conceptions correspond to anything real and possible? All yoga asserts them as its ultimate experience and supreme aim. They form the governing principles of our highest possible state of consciousness, our widest possible range of existence. There is, we say, a harmony of supreme faculties, corresponding roughly to the psychological faculties of revelation, inspiration, and intuition. Yet acting not in the intuitive reason or the divine mind, but on a still higher plane, which see truth directly face to face, or rather live in the truth of things both universal and transcendent, and are its formulation and luminous activity. And these faculties are the light of a conscious existence superseding the egoistic and itself both cosmic and transcendent, the nature of which is bliss. These are obviously divine and, as man is at present apparently constituted, superhuman states of consciousness and activity. A trinity of transcendent existence, self-awareness, and self-delight is indeed the metaphysical description of the supreme Atman, the self-formulation to our awakened knowledge of the unknowable, whether conceived as a pure impersonality or as a cosmic personality manifesting the universe, Satchidananda. But in yoga, they are regarded also in their psychological aspects of states of subjective existence to which our waking consciousness is now alien, but which dwell in us in a superconscious plane, and to which, therefore, we may always ascend. For, as is indicated by the name causal body, as opposed to the two others which are instruments, this crowning manifestation is also the source and effective power of all that in the actual evolution has preceded it. Our mental activities are, indeed, a derivation, selection, and So long as they are divided from the truth that is secretly their source, a deformation of the divine knowledge. Our sensations and emotions have the same relation to the bliss, our vital forces and actions to the aspect of will or force assumed by the divine consciousness, our physical being to the pure essence of that bliss and consciousness. The evolution which we observe, and of which we are the terrestrial summit, may be considered, in a sense, as an inverse manifestation, by which these supreme powers, in their unity and their diversity, use, develop, and perfect the imperfect substance and activities of matter, of life and of mind, so that they, the inferior modes, may express, in mutable relativity, an increasing harmony of the divine and eternal states from which they are born. If this be the truth of the universe, then the goal of evolution is also its cause. It is that which is immanent in its elements, and out of them is liberated. But the liberation is surely imperfect if it is only an escape, and there is no return upon the containing substance and activities to exalt and transform them. The immanence itself would have no credible reason for being if it did not end in such a transfiguration. But if human mind can become capable of the glories of the divine light, human emotion and sensibility can be transformed into the mold and assume the measure and movement of the supreme bliss. Human action not only represent but feel itself to be the motion of a divine and non-egoistic force, and the physical substance of our being sufficiently partake of the purity of the supernal essence, sufficiently unify plasticity and durable constancy to support and prolong these highest experiences and agencies. Then all the long labor of nature will end in a crowning justification, and her evolutions reveal their profound significance. So dazzling is even a glimpse of this supreme existence, and so absorbing its attraction that, once seen, we feel readily justified in neglecting all else for its pursuit. Even by an opposite exaggeration to that which sees all things in mind and the mental life as an exclusive ideal, mind comes to be regarded as an unworthy deformation and a supreme obstacle, the source of an illusory universe, a negation of the truth, and itself to be denied and all its works and results annulled if we desire the final liberation. But this is a half-truth which errs by regarding only the actual limitations of mind and ignores its divine intention. The ultimate knowledge is that which perceives and accepts God in the universe as well as beyond the universe. The integral yoga is that which, having found the transcendent, can return upon the universe and possess it, retaining the power freely to descend as well as ascend the great stair of existence. For if the eternal wisdom exists at all, the faculty of mind also must have some high use and destiny. That use must depend on its place in the ascent and in the return, and that destiny must be a fulfillment and transfiguration, not a rooting out or an annulling. We perceive, then, these three steps in nature: a bodily life, which is the basis of our existence here in the material world; a mental life, into which we emerge, and by which we raise the bodily to higher uses and enlarge it into a greater completeness; and a divine existence, which is at once the goal of the other two, and returns upon them to liberate them into their highest possibilities. Regarding none of them as either beyond our reach or below our nature, and the destruction of none of them as essential to the ultimate attainment, we accept this liberation and fulfillment as part, at least, and a large and important part of the aim of yoga. End of chapter 2, page 19.